From NPR News, this is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. Following the death of Terry Schiavo, Congressman Tom DeLay commented that the judges who had ordered the brain-damaged woman's feeding tube removed and then refused to reinsert it would someday have to answer for their behavior. In the weeks since, a chorus of conservative voices have criticized what they consider liberal activism within the judiciary. Last week, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia weighed in.
You cannot adopt a theory that the Constitution is evolving and the Supreme Court will tell you what it means from age to age without causing the Supreme Court to become a very political institution. And when that happens, the people in a democracy will try to seize control of it.
Justice Scalia's comments come as two of President Bush's most controversial judicial nominees, Janice Rogers Brown and Priscilla Owen, returned to the full Senate for consideration. During the president's first term, Democrats filibustered a confirmation vote, charging that the two nominees were conservatively activists. Here to help us make sense of all this political wrangling are Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, who has spent a considerable amount of time before the Supreme Court, and one of President Bush's first judicial appointees, Judge Reggie B. Walton, United States District Judge for the District of Columbia. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Professor Tribe, let me start with you and ask you about the term judicial activism. Do you buy it as a plausible term?
No, it's really a bumper sticker, and it's very often used simply when one disagrees with what the court is doing. You know, a lot of the people who decry what they call judicial activism when the courts protect the freedom of speech or separation of church and state or privacy are the very same people who are upset when courts do not jump into the fray to protect Terry Schiavo. It's really a question of whose ox is gored. I think we can all agree that it's very important for judges to do their very best to interpret the legal materials in front of them. Most judges think they're doing that, and it would be a lot better if we would focus more specifically on what we think is right or wrong about the way judges are acting than simply throwing around a slogan that really can be used by anyone to describe what they don't agree with.
Judge, that being said, that slogan is being used by a lot of people. How comfortable, if at all, are you with the current environment that we've seen on Capitol Hill and in Washington specifically?
Well, some degree of antagonism, I guess, between the various branches is healthy in a democracy. I do think that it can rise to the level where it becomes destructive, and I am concerned in that regard.
Do you believe it's headed that way?
I'm fearful that it may be, and I don't think that that in the long run of the future of this country would be healthy.
Professor, let me ask you, historically, we have seen this kind of environment periodically. This is nothing new. Do you think that we're seeing it perhaps at a more heightened level than ever before?
I think it is more extreme now. I think the combination of the extreme polarization in partisan terms, the lack of any meaningful dialogue across the aisle between people on the right and the left in Washington, the heightened level of physical violence against judges, something which I think is not completely new, but is at an alarming level. I think all of that has come together at a level that is much more threatening to the independence of the judiciary than I've seen in my lifetime.
Judge, let me ask you in terms of what the professor just suggested, and that's the independence of the judiciary. There are times where the judiciary is ahead of the curve, often in making decisions, oftentimes unpopular ones at the time. Do you believe that that is first and foremost what this branch of government should do? And do you feel comfortable in knowing that you will have the wherewithal to do it without political backlash?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate circumstance that judges have been placed in. I don't think any of us relish having to make these type of decisions ahead of the curve. I think, unfortunately, many times the other branches of government have not acted expeditiously to address issues, and as a result of that, they fall in our lap, And many times we have to decide them. Where in, you know, an ideal situation, we may not. And I don't think we can worry about the backlash as far as the individual decisions that we make. But obviously, since I believe in the judicial process and have concerns about its independence remaining as it historically has been, I think it can conceivably have a chilling effect in a general perspective.
Do you believe that to be the case, Professor, that oftentimes when we see the judiciary ahead of the curve, we see a lagging, if you will, in the other two branches? I think historically of Roe v. Wade or Brown v. Board, and of course the Schiavo case most recently. Does that signal, if you will, a slowing down of the process politically?
Well, I think sometimes the image of being ahead or behind the curve is a little misleading. I mean, in a case like Roe v. Wade, perhaps the court moved a bit ahead of where most of the country was, and maybe it moved, as Justice Ruth Ginsburg has herself suggested, maybe it moved a little too fast for the adjustment of the society. But in many other areas, the propulsion for progress has come from outside the courts, and the courts have simply ratified something that's going on. I mean, the women's movement secured the 19th Amendment in 1920. It took 50 years beyond that for the U.S. Supreme Court to finally recognize that equality for women was part of the mandate of the 14th Amendment. And when it did so, it was making sure that the society wouldn't sort of slip back too much. And in the context of desegregation, it's certainly true that Brown versus Board of Education was a rallying cry well ahead of where the South was, but the country hasn't even today caught up with the full meaning of Brown v. Board. And a lot of the courageous judges in the South who really put their lives on the line in making sure that the principle of Brown remained alive really had to fight hard not to be activist, but simply to be principled. And I'm really grateful that we continue to have judges, Judge Walton among them, who are principled enough sort of not to keep a finger to the wind and ask whether Tom DeLay or someone else is going to be upset by what they do.
Judge, what of the growing debate that we see in terms of an originalist versus one who leaves room for interpretation of the law? I'm wondering where you feel most comfortable.
I think I would consider myself, in a sense, well, an originalist. I do think it's important for judges to seek to interpret the law consistent with how it was enacted. Unfortunately, many times legislation is not as clear as it should have been, sometimes I think intentionally, and therefore interpretation has to occur. And therefore, you hope that you have well-intended judges, which I believe we by and large have, who use their knowledge and their perception of what the legislature intended, and you try and reach a result consistent with what you believe that intent was. But I do think it's important for judges to try to stick to the terms of legislation so long as that legislation clearly indicates exactly what the intent was. But as I said, many times that's not sometimes always the case.
Professor, are we seeing the judiciary in cases before it becoming, in your mind, too political? Many have pointed out the incendiary remarks of Tom DeLay and the question of filibuster as a tool in terms of stopping nominations that you may not agree with. Do you believe it to be too political at this point?
Well, I'm afraid it has become virtually paralyzed. I suppose political is another word for a form of paralysis. It's very hard for either side to stand down when unilateral disarmament doesn't work. That is, it's very easy to say to the others, let's calm down, let's seek consensus, let's look for candidates who do not incite the kind of passions on both sides that have become characteristic. But if either the Democrats or the Republicans begin playing ball that way. They really are not sure that they've got a team on the other side. I don't know how to begin to have the process assume sanity again. I mean, for example, it's been a long tradition that judges very often who are nominated to high courts don't even get to the floor of the Senate. The issue of filibuster doesn't come up because they're essentially pocket filibustered. That yeah. happened for 200 years. Then the Democrats sort of begin doing it more openly with filibusters on the floor. The Republicans say that's unprecedented. Well, that's true only if you don't look at the pocket filibusters. It's like a game of chicken, and I think both sides recognize that the whole character of the Senate of the United States could be profoundly changed because there's an attempt to get rid of the filibuster rule. I think it would be wonderful if a compromise could be worked out, if the Democrats were to agree to confirm one or two of the more controversial judges and the Republicans were to recognize that having had over 200 confirmed, they really don't have to be good to the last drop, as it were. But whether sanity and compromise will prevail really depends on a degree of statecraft and reason that I'm hopeful we have, but I'm not sure we do.
Well, sanity and compromise in Washington, D.C. We'll see if indeed that happens. Professor Lawrence Tribe teaches at Harvard University Law School there, and Judge Reggie B. Walton, a United States District Judge for the District of Columbia. I thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks.